Welcome to Allocation Disorder. I am Sam. He is Paul. We are coming to you on the back of one of the most crazy weeks that I can remember in the world of soccer in quite some time. We don't have a nostalgic 90s snack for you, but I do have a nostalgic 2000s soccer tournament. Not the Super League, Paul. Superliga. You remember that thing?
Of course I do. I grew up a DC United fan. Of course I know the Superliga.
Yeah, but this wasn't like your childhood, old man.
Yeah, but still, DC United was a regular of the Superliga.
Did you ever cover Superliga? For those who don't know, Superliga was the original League's Cup between MLS and League MX. It was just like a, what, two-week tournament, essentially, at one site most of the time, or two sites in North America. It changed around a little
Actually, the Superliga was like definitely way after my like fandom years. I was a professional journalist
I covered the Superliga.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, anyway, it was a weird little tournament. There was a $1 million cash prize for the winner that they would carry around in a suitcase at some of these tournaments. So the stakes were kind of cool.
DC United wasn't even in the Superliga. They never played in the Superliga.
You're just making stuff up.
I was thinking of the Intercontinental Championship. That's what I was thinking of.
How dare you? So, the Superliga, the original League's Cup, the original Super League. And that, of course, is the big news that I was referring to off the top of the show. It looked like European soccer was going to change fundamentally forever on Sunday night. And by Tuesday, it had all blown up and we're back to somewhat of the status quo, although the Champions League did change and sort of everyone forgot about that a little bit. So that model's going to be a little bit different. Paul, this was a whirlwind. We've talked about it a little bit offline. I just want to like pull back a little here. And we're gonna talk about MLS and Liga MX and North American soccer and kind of how all of this stuff sort of ties in a little bit and what it might mean and what it could have meant. But I want to pull back and just ask you, how did you process this? Because this was a ride, man.
Yeah, I mean, it was like one of the most fun eras for me of Twitter. Like, usually Twitter's not fun. There's a lot of doom scrolling. And if you work in American soccer, there's a lot of just like negativity in general. This was actually a lot of fun to watch go down because it felt like everyone was fighting against like the same enemy. Like,
yeah.
Corporate greed ruining an institution. Like, you're not going to be on the wrong side of that one. And like, very few people were.
Well, and 12 people were.
Yeah. I mean, and so it was really interesting. I thought from multiple angles for me, you know, one, to kind of watch the coverage unfold from the inside, from our side of things, and thinking of it as like a journalist and watching the UK team of The Athletic attack the story from every different angle, I thought was super fascinating.
Yeah.
But just to watch kind of the way the dominoes fell of, you know, how the fans reacted, how the players reacted, then kind of the government reaction to that fan reaction where they recognized that they could get some real positive popularity points by backing the fans. And then, you know, the UEFA reactions. It was just a really fascinating kind of real life. I don't
drama.
Even know. Yeah.
It was like drama.
It was crazy. It was really, I think, Sam, like, I think it's probably one of like the most like defining like soccer events that I've been alive for. Right. Like, Sam, I know you, I enjoyed it. Sam, you were like bathing in it.
I was like mainlining this stuff. I was going nuts. Like, and for some reason I was a little slow to it. I think because like during the weekends I try and log off Twitter a little bit. And so I didn't really see it Sunday until late. And then I was like, it's just like the same thing they do every 2-3 years, whatever. I didn't really take it seriously. I was watching MLS and I wake up Monday morning and I'm like, oh, okay. This is different than what I thought it was. And I start sort of ingesting all of the content. And like, I put this on Twitter the other day, but it's the old Darren Revelle tweet from the 2016 election night where, you know, he says, I'm worried for our country, but this is tremendous content. And like, that was a little bit too glib. I was like, I'm worried for our sport, but this is tremendous content. That's how I felt. I didn't feel like I crossed a line there because it was kind of falling apart when I said that. But hey, you know, if you want to hate me, go ahead. But yeah, I was like mainlining this thing. It was crazy. It was just, everything was a mile a minute. I was on the phone. It was Tuesday that it all fell apart. And I was on the phone Tuesday with people that work in European soccer, buddies of mine, people in MLS, just friends of mine from growing up that we used to get up at 6 a.m. and watch Premier League games in someone's basement, who are still fans of like Liverpool or Man U or whatever, and just talking to them. And, you know, I was on the phone actually with an MLS GM in the afternoon on Tuesday. And like, we were like screaming at each other almost about this thing, because this guy had some terrible takes and I can't really even remember them because they were bad. Just know that they were bad. And so we were going back and forth, and I'm like, how can you think that this isn't the worst thing in the world? And by the time I hang up my phone, I'm like, oh, Man City's out. And then it's like, oh, Chelsea's out. I'm like, okay, this thing's done. This ain't happening. And then Woodward is out. He's resigning, and Agnelli. And I mean, the thing that was like, to me, I don't know. I kind of have this weird, maybe it's not weird, but a sense of humor where I kind of like think this stuff's funny. And to see Seferin, the head of UEFA, whose name I probably just butchered, the godfather of Agnelli, the head of Juventus's daughter, to see him go on Monday and call this man a snake, in like stare directly into the camera and call this man a snake. It was like, it was a soap opera. It was like Game of Thrones. Like, it was wild. I'm glad that the Super League didn't come to pass, and that makes all of this a lot more funny than sad and doom and gloom, because I think it would have been a real shame. But, you know, and now we can kind of sit back and laugh about it. And I just got to say, I cannot wait for the 30 for 30. I cannot wait for the books. Like, give that to me now. I want it now. So, yeah, I really enjoyed kind of the whole story. But we also, you know, we've been talking to people about it, Paul, around American soccer. And it's worth kind of diving into that a little bit as well, I think.
I also want to say, and I know I keep going back to this, and it's way too, like, I don't know, media centric. I know, considering how
you're gonna go journalism school on us here.
I just think
Paul went to Medill, folks.
No, I just so did you. I just feel so like I really enjoyed the content that came out of this. You know, like to your point, like tremendous content. Like the TikTok stories that came out of this. Shout out to our team in the UK. You know, Dominic Fifield, Sam Lee, Matt Slater, Laurie Whitwell, Liam Toomey, Jack Pitbrook, James Pierce, who wrote kind of our TikTok, Tariq Panja and Rory Smith, who are just tremendous at what they do for the New York Times.
Every time I read their stuff, I'm like really excited to read it. And by the end of it, I'm like, wow, that was amazing. And then I get really mad because I'm like, I'll never do anything like that. I got no chance. What's even the point of doing any of this?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think both of those guys, you know, it's kind of aspirational to read what they do from the global perspective, and it's incredibly difficult. And I think I really enjoyed kind of the so many different angles to approach this story, so many different sources that were talking, and so much great detail of how this unfolded that happened so quickly.
Yeah.
For people, because so many people were willing to talk because it was such a disaster. So if you haven't read these pieces, I really recommend going to read them. At The Athletic, our headline is "The Day the Super League Collapsed. How Can We Ever Work With These People Again?"
Which was the day after it was born.
Right, exactly. So just, you know, just go take the time to read that piece. Take the time to read the New York Times piece for sure. That has some of the detail that Sam was just talking about, you know, like the kind of give and take between the UEFA president and the president of Juventus, and the relationship between their families, and the fact
Paul, can you just imagine some of these guys, Agnelli, Woodward, they spent years on this, and they spent years lying straight to the faces of their colleagues, of their competitors, and in some of these cases, they're very close personal friends. It's insane. And then it all blew up on them in a matter of hours because the rollout of this thing was a joke. Complete
really
joke.
Bad.
How do you do this with it and do it so poorly? That's crazy to me.
I mean, you knew it wasn't going to be good when you saw the logo, right? Like, that was like the first sign that this was not going to happen.
I mean, I don't know. bad logos, you can overcome. No,
you can't
logos.
Spend years working on a project and you put out a release and your logo looks like that. That means you did not plan it out well enough. That's what that means.
I mean, they literally had like no PR strategy.
Their
PR strategy was like Florentino Perez go on some weird Spanish late night talk show and like pretend that, I don't know, behave like you're soccer Trump, basically.
Let's not badmouth late night soccer talk shows. That's essentially allocation disorder.
I mean, I don't think it was a soccer talk show. I think it was just a regular late night show.
Doesn't matter.
I'm not bad-mouthing the show, but that's your PR strategy?
No one else was willing to answer questions. Florentino was the only one.
But why he, on that
still out, like, the only one. It's kind of a tradition in Spain to do like the midnight, late-night talk show.
What was it called? El Chiringuito?
Yeah.
Was that the name of the show?
Yeah.
Great name for a show.
Great name. Great name. Very jealous of that name.
This episode of Allocation Disorder is brought to you by El Chiringuito. Can't believe I forgot that off the top.
So Sam, what, you know, in all the conversations you've had, you've written some columns about it.
I'd
encourage people to go check out the column Sam wrote regarding kind of the similarities and the goals of the Super League and of Major League Soccer, which is to be soccer's NFL. You know, in all these conversations that you had, what's your takeaway on kind of the American perspective on this? Is there a, you know, lesson to be learned here? Is there an impact on soccer on this side of the ocean, you think, out of what happened in the last 48 hours or so?
I think there are a million things to take away from it, right? So I'll start with what I wrote about, which is maybe the least fantastical, most boring version of this entire discussion, but we'll start there. And so I spoke with two guys who run MLS teams, Ernst Tanner in Philadelphia and Axel Schuster in Vancouver, and they both come from Europe. They're both German. They've both worked for Champions League clubs in the past, Schuster with Schalke, Tanner with Red Bull Salzburg. I don't think Hoffenheim was making Champions League when he was there, but anyway, he was at Hoffenheim as well. And so I'm like, hey, well, what'd you think about this? And they are like, it's a joke, right? And this is the worst. And for all of the normal reasons that I think it's the worst, and Paul, I think you think it's the worst, and that most people listening think it's the worst. But it's kind of funny to hear that coming out of the mouth of somebody who runs an MLS team, right? Because you're complaining about this new Super League that's going to be closed off, right? And I'm like, well, I mean, it's more closed off, but it's not as closed off as MLS, right? You were going to have 15 permanent spots in this Super League and 5 to-be-determined qualifying slots that would be open to theoretically most teams in Europe. And MLS, there's no way to get in on sporting merit, right? It's a completely closed system, just like every other major North American pro sports league. And so I asked both of them to sort of square that with their comments. And they're like, well, it's the culture, it's the history. And fair enough. The culture and the history are way different. And I think it's important to note in any of these discussions that if MLS was founded with promotion and relegation and an open pyramid and all of that stuff, it never would have gotten off the ground. Right,
yeah,
Paul?
I mean, in fact, like there's a document going around. I think it came out, you know, in this lawsuit, the relevant lawsuit of like a league that had been designed with three tiers, regional leagues in the third division, you know, a first division, pro division, a second pro division, and a real pyramid. And you know, this was approved by the USSF. And like that was the original idea behind launching professional soccer in the United States. Here's the problem. No one signed up for it.
No one signed up to fund it.
No one signed up to buy teams in it. No one was interested in taking part in professional soccer that looked like that. And that is the big difference we have to remember of any comparison of Major League Soccer is that, you know, we're talking about 100 years of an institution in Europe.
Right.
Or I more, mean, right? Like that's a tradition. It's a culture. In the United States, there was a culture of leagues coming and going, being founded and disappearing for numerous different reasons. And so in order to create something that was permanent, they had to find a way that they could entice people to invest. And ultimately, after that pyramid design failed to entice anyone to invest, they came up, Alan Rothenberg came up with a single entity idea that then became Major League Soccer. And that's what we have today. And I also want to point out, Sam, before you keep going,
yeah,
for all we criticize it for, we do have to acknowledge that, you know, after what had been kind of a wild, wild west existence of American soccer for so long in the kind of modern era preceding this one, you know, Major League Soccer has achieved permanence in a way that no other league has before. Yeah. When you look at the facilities and everything else. And
it ain't going anywhere.
That's and USL during this era has been formed and has really, you know, created its own footprint in this country. So the design, the model worked for the American investor. And, you know, changing that, I think, is similar to trying to change the traditions in Europe. Like, I think the columns that were written trying to compare college football to the Super League or the NFL to the Super League, they don't work because they already are the Super League, right? The Super League was mimicking the American culture of sport.
Sure.
You know, to create something that would have incited the same type of uproar on this side of the ocean, you would have to say, hey, Power Five schools, here's how we're going to do it. The teams that finish with the five worst records in their Power Five conferences are going to go down to the Group of Five. And the teams that finish with the five best records in the Group of Five are going to go up to the Power Five.
I think people would love that, though.
I don't think the institutions would. I don't think the fans of the SEC would.
That's why it doesn't happen.
I don't think people would love it. But even, you know, having covered UCF, you talk about UCF wanting to get a chance in the college football playoff.
I want you to mention UCF football on every episode.
I'm just saying, like, look at the reaction of fans of Auburn and Georgia and Alabama when UCF fans were saying, we deserve a shot at a national championship.
Yeah.
And they were like, absolutely not. You do not deserve a shot. And then they were like, oh, you know, if you guys go undefeated again next year, you deserve a shot. And then UCF went undefeated again the next year and they did not get a shot. And those fans weren't clamoring for UCF to get a shot. So, I mean, no,
like
no
a lot of
like it.
A lot of the country was, though, man.
Not
it's
really,
just the,
man.
It's just the other teams that are in contention for the championship spot that don't want it.
I just think that that's being nice to what Auburn was. Auburn lost to UCF that year. They weren't, I mean, they were a one loss team, so I guess they technically were in contention. But but the idea of people embracing a change to an institution, I think it's hard to fathom, right? It doesn't
happen.
Fans
would welcome pro rel in American soccer. Many would. I mean, I don't know. I'm with you on most of the things you said. I'm not really with you on that last part. Regardless, the history, the culture sort of dictate these things. And you hear MLS execs talk about it all the time, man, right? They're like, oh, we go talk to these guys that are running European clubs, these owners of European clubs, and they always say, oh, we love your model. If we were starting today, we would do it like you. We would never do pro rel. And they wouldn't, right? Because you're risking losing a ton of money. And that's why it doesn't exist.
Real quickly, sorry to interject again, but I do agree with you that, yes, of course people would be fine with pro rel in American soccer because it's not an institution. It's been around for 25 years. It's not the same thing. That's the whole point. Sorry.
Fair enough. College football keeps changing all the time too, but whatever. We don't need to go down that rabbit hole any further. So it's just kind of interesting, right? Because MLS has this closed model. The Super League was a shift towards a more closed model in an attempt to really just kind of hoover up more of the dollars, essentially, to create more revenue and to keep more of it and to be guaranteed it in perpetuity regardless of results. And like that's kind of what the NFL is. That's what the American and Canadian sports model is, right? And I get why the owners would want to do that. I cannot believe they actually tried it in this way. It shows a complete lack of understanding of where they're coming from in terms of the teams and the leagues and the history. But they went for it. It failed spectacularly. But there are some benefits of the way MLS runs. You mentioned the permanence, right? The stability. You know, you hear Madrid and Barcelona in particular kind of talking about, oh, we need a more sustainable model. And it's like, well, yeah, you do. You could make it more sustainable if you just didn't spend your way into oblivion, right? But the MLS model doesn't allow you to spend your way into oblivion. Like, literally, it puts rules on against it. And you and I rail against those rules all the time. And I'm still going to. I'm not going to change that. Because all of this is just about finding the right spot on the spectrum, right? And Europe is not on the right spot on the spectrum, in my opinion. Right? You have teams like Barcelona that are $1.3 billion in debt, right? That's not a sustainable thing. Like, you can't keep doing that forever, right? Something is going to have to change there. You have leagues like Germany where Bayern wins every single year. Italy, Juve probably is not going to win this year, but they won 9 previous. PSG, I think they've won 8 of 9 titles. And the 1 year they lost to Monaco. Well, what did they do? They went out and bought Monaco's best player, Kylian Mbappe, right? Spain, it's a two-club league for the most part, with Atletico sneaking in here or there, and maybe they'll do it again this year. But that's not really that exciting. England, it rotates a little bit more, right? So the Premier League, I think, has enough ambitious clubs where they have 6 that really go for it, and sometimes Leicester sneaks in and win. And so, like, you can have the champions there rotate, and it's a little bit more interesting. But the financial instability of a lot of these European clubs and the general lack of competitive balance on a lot of the domestic leagues, I think, is no good, right? And MLS has financial stability, even if these teams aren't profiting, and it has competitive balance, right? Now, I would like to see, and I wrote this in the column, I would love to see MLS open it up more, right? Shift more towards Europe with less restrictions. And you can do that, right? In a way that doesn't lose competitive balance or financial stability, right? You can ease off the brake a little bit, and you can still keep things that are good, and you can open things up more. And Europe, I think vice versa, you know, some of the controls, FFP could get a little bit stronger, right? And clubs could kind of be more reasonable with their spending, and revenue sharing could maybe be more equitable. I don't know. There are ways to make the competitive balance more interesting and make it so clubs aren't going into bankruptcy and administration as well. So,
yeah, I mean, there are examples for MLS to follow within the American sports spectrum, right, of how to enhance their spending and still maintain controls. It's called salary caps and it's called luxury taxes. And those things have worked and do work in the leagues that are played side by side with Major League Soccer in the United States and Canada. So there is no excuse for Major League Soccer to spend as little as they're spending, other than the fact that the ownership
Not even as little, man. And Axel Schuster mentioned this to me explicitly, and I put it in the story. It's just how they're allowed to spend, right? He's like, you know, just like, maybe we take away the designated player rule, and sort of hinting at, like, just give us a set amount of money and we can spend to it any way we want. And then you can still have a team. And he said, you can still have a team that goes out and signs Carlos Vela, and you can have another team that takes that same amount of money and spreads it across 4 or 5 different guys. Like,
yeah, but that still comes down to the amount of money, right? Like, if your salary cap, if you do that and your salary cap is $20 million, you know, you're still falling short of your sure. rivals in Mexico. If you do that and your cap is $30 million and you do something similar to, I believe it's the NFL that has a minimum of 80% of the salary cap spend for teams to try to keep yeah. competition as close as possible, then you have a very competitive league that's competitive with Mexico, certainly, and with some of the leagues in Europe or many of the other teams in Europe. So, you know, that matters. I think also on the flip side, when you look at Europe, FFP definitely needs more teeth. We learned that
financial fair play.
Yeah, we learned that with Manchester City and its sanctions. It's difficult, right? Because when you start talking about the restrictions that you're going to put in European football and in global football, it requires the participation of multiple governments on antitrust laws that exist and are different in all these different countries. Getting a country like China to agree to the same types of rules that exist in England, all of those things matter, right? They do matter.
It matters when you're talking about like a global competition. But if the Premier League wanted to do it, that's just one country, right? They can, you know, it's messy. I'm not saying it's not, but it's not any different than doing it here necessarily.
I don't think any country is going to do it until they feel like it's going to be, when it comes to something like FIFA financial fair play, that is going to be enforceable in more than just a couple countries, right? That's the challenge that FIFA faces.
Because you don't want to be lagging behind everybody else. You got to keep up with the Joneses, which is a big reason why these clubs are in the situation they're in right now, right? Which, by the way, it's good, right? Competition is good. That's the whole damn point, right? Like, Pep Guardiola had the quote, kind of, and I use this in the story as well, but like, sport where it doesn't matter when you lose, that's not sport, right? That's just like content, essentially. And in many ways, that's what we have here in the US. You know, thankfully, in a lot of these leagues, like, these teams are ambitious enough where it sort of mitigates it, right? But, like, you know, I heard somebody defending the closed model as, like, a way, using tanking as an example, and, like, holding up the Houston Astros. And I got so mad, because I was like, all right, yeah, the Astros intentionally sucked for years so they could stockpile draft picks, and those draft picks hit, and they eventually turned into a garbage can banging, cheating World Series champion, right? So it worked. But so many teams try to tank, and it doesn't really work for many of them, you know? Like, the ones that turn into a champion, it's rare. That's the exception. And even the ones where you do turn into a champion, how many years? How many years do you put your fan base through crap, right?
But again, there, like, are ways to protect against tanking, right? The NFL does a very good job of doing that. They're, you know, you can do it without being the same as MLS. And, like,
exactly. And I don't know. There is a sweet spot. The other part of this that's weird to me, and I'm sorry I cut you off, but the other part of this that's weird to me is, like, here I am advocating for salary caps when it's like, well, am I taking money out of players' pockets there? Because that's, like, not really something I want to do either. So I don't know. I don't know what I want here.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a big part of the problem we have to recognize is that, you know, a lot of this money, you know, when you talk about Barcelona's debt, I was talking to somebody today who was saying, like, I've yet to see a model that works financially when you spend 150% of revenue on players. It's amazing that the books don't work at that point, right?
Yeah, it's wild.
So you know, when that much money is going into player salaries, that you end up with Barcelona, right? You can make all this money, but when you're so far exceeding your revenue and even your projected revenue on contracts that are as big as they are, you know, for players like Messi and before him Neymar, and, you know, you look at
Coutinho, Dembele,
right?
You go guys down that the haven't list, even performed necessarily for
that it's unsustainable. So does spending need to be pared back in the player side of things? Yes. Does it need to be? Are there ways beyond salary to do that? Of course.
Agent
fees are out of control. Agent fees are out of control. All those things can be brought back. I think caps on agent fees is, yeah, like a really easy place to go. First.
Tanner was going nuts about agent fees when I talked to him about it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's difficult, right? Like, you can't, I mean, at least in this country, you can't conspire to, I don't think, to cap agent fees, right? To cap the money of somebody who doesn't work for you. Like, I think that's like a
MLS has some system with agent fees that I meant to look up the other day.
I don't know. Every team's different. I mean, I know some teams that refuse to pay any agent fees, yeah, or claim to, and some teams that just pay them, you know. It's, I think, you know, there is a reasonable place to land. Like, to me, it's like, you'll hear agents complaining, but, like, there is a reasonable place,
yeah,
to land with something like agent fees, you know?
Yeah.
And by not capping agent fees, you're driving up the prices on these transfers. You're driving up the frequency of some of these big money transfers, yeah, because these agents are getting paid for the transfers. So there are a lot of different solutions. I think it's just fascinating because it really, what it does is it shines a light on all these different areas where things can get reformed and can get better in European, mm-hmm, football, certainly in Major League Soccer. I mean, this whole podcast is dedicated to the places and the ways that, you know, Major League Soccer can get better at a lot of different things. And I think, yeah, we stay on that, you know, stay on that level.
Yeah. And I'll say this and then we'll break, but The key to me here, if you're designing any league in Europe, here, anywhere in the world, it's about finding that sweet spot on the spectrum between stability and competitive balance on the one side and, like, free reign and ambition on the other. And to me, I feel like the NFL is probably the best in the world. They've found the sweet spot on that. I think MLS is way too far to the stability and competitive balance side. And I think Europe is probably too far to the free reign and ambition side. But you can find a sweet spot on that spectrum. And the other thing with this is, if there's one thing the Super League taught me, it's that anything is possible. And we'll talk more about that after the break.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help you find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn, though, isn't just a job board. It helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. Speaking from experience, hiring for a small business, it's difficult when you're wearing so many hats. You might not have the time or the resources to hire. LinkedIn makes it very easy to complete the job hiring process. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. Comes very well recommended from this guy. And also 2.5 million small businesses who are using LinkedIn for hiring. On LinkedIn, did you know 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours? That's a quick turnaround to hire professionals on LinkedIn. So post your job for free at linkedin.com/TSS. That's linkedin.com/TSS to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. A thank you.
And we are back. Allocation disorder. Anything is possible. To quote the legend, Kevin Garnett.
Anything is possible. I have a theory about that. I have a theory about that moment, that Kevin Garnett moment.
Yeah.
Kevin Garnett, as you know, is sponsored by what KG. Apparel company or was?
Adidas.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And at the time, Adidas
Impossible is Nothing. Yeah.
They had the Impossible is Nothing campaign. I'm pretty sure
he
that
meant
they
to say
had
that.
Paid him to, if he won, scream Impossible is Nothing for like their ad campaign. And that he just in the beauty of the moment of, you know, whatever, didn't remember exactly what it was.
Yeah. He got caught up a little.
And he screamed Anything is Possible instead. Great moment. Not for Adidas, though.
I'm pretty sure Adidas still used that in marketing materials.
They used it, but he didn't deliver the line. That's my theory of what he was, what the plan
was.
I thought
that at the time. And then I believe it got into the I'm on a Boat video, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think Joe knows I'm on a Boat? Well, pulling back the curtain a little bit here, Joe Lowry edits our show. Hi, Joe. And every week, Joe is 4 years old, so every week, Paul and I, when we send him the audio of our show, we send him a different viral video from like the mid-2000s or like late aughts or something like that. So I don't know, man. I'm on a Boat. That was like 08, 09. He might not know that. He didn't know Lazy Sunday.
Yeah, he's a baby. And you're corrupting him. You're corrupting him is what's happening.
This show is corrupting him.
We've sent him some inappropriate videos. Not like that kind of inappropriate, but certainly ones that can
speak for yourself.
Young Joe.
I am wholesome. Thank
you're,
you.
You're anything but that.
Wow.
Even the listeners of this show know that.
All right. Well, anything is possible. speaking of, anything is possible with this, right? If COVID and all of the changes that came to the soccer calendar because of the pandemic, and the Super League has taught us anything, is that anything is possible. Even the most far-fetched sounding idea is possible, which brings me to MLS and Liga MX. Actually, no. Let me wind it back. Sorry. Change up. Let me wind it back. If this Super League had gone forward, Paul, I want to spend some time on this hypothetical. If this Super League had gone forward, they would have been playing games here in the U.S. What, over under 18 months? 2 years?
Under, for sure. And I would say over 2 years on this, there would have been an expansion team.
Yeah,
I
love it.
In New York and Miami. Two expansion teams.
Wow.
One in New York, one in Miami that would have been competing in the Super League.
Stephen Ross definitely would have owned one of those.
For sure.
Maybe probably Miami since he owns
the other one probably would have been like Joey Saputo, you know, like or something like that.
Rocco Commisso?
Yeah, exactly.
New York Cosmos?
Exactly.
In the Super League?
Oh, it was definitely the chance for the Cosmos to make a comeback, for sure.
I mean, like, honestly, in some ways, that would have been brutal for MLS had that happened. Brutal.
Sam, how quickly would you transition from the Athletics national soccer reporter covering mostly MLS to the Athletics New York Cosmos Super League beat reporter?
Wow, man. I mean, as you know, I'm a huge Cosmos supporter.
Huge.
Those are my team. That's my team. No, but this, like, on a serious note, like, that could have been brutal for MLS. And it could have been incredible for American soccer. Incredible. And part of me is a little sad that it didn't happen. Because if that threat emerged, MLS would have had to step up its game like that.
Drastically. Drastically.
Like, it could have accelerated things so much. And it would have been fascinating to see how it played out. Because all of a sudden, why would any of these European stars ever go to an MLS team, right? If they can still play in the Super League, still get the American lifestyle, still get the big money.
Are you kidding me? It would have been a totally different demographic of star, man. We are talking about
no, you'd be getting Mbappe them in their prime.
Playing
in
New
their
York,
prime.
You know what I
in
mean?
In their prime.
That's what it would have been. That's what it
like,
would have been.
It would have been insane. It would have been totally incredible. It would have been a huge threat to MLS, but a huge opportunity for MLS and for American soccer as well. And so part of me is a little bit sad that it didn't happen because that would have been cool for us, right? And for fans here in the States. But we absolutely would have seen very quickly Manchester United playing at Raymond James and, you know, Arsenal playing at whatever the Rams stadium is called, SoFi Stadium, and Liverpool, you know, they would have been reconfiguring Fenway to fit a regulation size field there. And, you know, Man City, I guess they would have kicked NYCFC out of Yankee Stadium and just made it their home. But it would have been, man, like the possibilities for that. Like, I wonder if MLS feels like they dodged a bullet in that regard.
Definitely. I think there certainly has to be a belief that some encouragement that the infrastructure of the global sport will prevent the big threats to American soccer and Major League Soccer from happening.
Look at the relevant
because the relevant case has always kind of lingered and still lingering.
Can you explain that? Because
in the relevant case, essentially, relevant is the company that that stages the ICC Summer Friendlies, the
International Champions Cup.
Right, where you see, you know, Manchester United play Barcelona in preseason and people spend $300 on tickets to see the B team play, right, in these non-competitive matches. And the ICC started with a great business model. It was making great money because people wanted to see the teams that they follow on television on Saturday mornings. They wanted to see them play. And fans were flocking to the stadiums, paying these outrageous prices for these seats. Well, eventually, soccer fans are intelligent. They started to see that the product was not worth the price, and people stopped going to the games. The attendance dropped, and, you know, the interest dropped. And I think Relevant was looking down the line and saying, "Look, the trends are going to keep going this way. You know, they're going to keep going downhill. They're not going to rebound. We need to find a way to generate more interest." And the best way to do that is to stage real games that matter, league games in the United States. And they attempted to do that, and U.S. soccer blocked it.
With La Liga. Who was it? Barcelona Getafe?
Yeah, they wanted to stage a La Liga game. It got blocked. Then they tried to stage, I believe it was like an Ecuadorian league game. Ecuadorian. And that got blocked.
Of those were going to be in Miami.
Right, yeah. Which is Stephen Ross is the financier behind this all. He's the owner of the Dolphins. And he was trying to kind of open this door. U.S. Soccer blocked it. FIFA blocked it. UEFA blocked it. The Spanish Federation blocked it. Spanish Players Association blocked it. No one
La Liga was all about it, though.
Yeah, La Liga was all about it. And you know, essentially, there is still a court case ongoing that basically U.S. law should supersede FIFA law. That FIFA's rules cannot violate antitrust law, and that right now that's what U.S. soccer and FIFA is doing by preventing open competition in the U.S. market for the top levels of the game. And so that's hovering over Major League Soccer, because the last thing they want is to have to fight for butts in the seat, right? They're already fighting and failing at least to win over more eyeballs compared to the Premier League, right, and League MX. Now imagine if suddenly, and hey, imagine League MX was staging regular season games now.
Oh, they'd be up here quick, man.
They'd be up here very quickly. And by the way, they're smart, right? They've, you know, they have these partnerships with Soccer United Marketing and MLS. These tournaments that they stage with MLS have often led to two League MX teams playing each other in a final in Las Vegas in the League's Cup last year.
2 years ago.
Or 2 years ago. This is the way that they're able to have these games and capitalize on those fans. But all that being said, that's a direct threat to Major League Soccer. And if that door gets opened, you know, we could see the Premier League do it. They tried before, prior to this relevant case. We could see.
I don't know about that.
And that was, again, that was pushed back and blocked by the players and the federations and the fans in England who didn't want to lose a home game, essentially.
Right.
So, you know, this news just kind of piles on top of that relevant thing to say, look, the game itself, the foundation of this game, the fans, the players, they don't want this to happen. And that's a good thing for Major League Soccer.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. And fan power, by the way, is a good thing for the sport. That was like the coolest thing to see from this whole fiasco, was that fan power won the day, because fans didn't really want this. Like, not, what did they call them? Legacy fans? Or like long-term stakeholders or something like that. Something disgusting and gross.
Yeah, I think stakeholders was definitely used.
Can I just say, I really hate the word stakeholders.
Like, well, it's stakeholders is proper when you're discussing actual stakeholders.
I don't like it in any context. I just don't like it. It's a pet peeve of mine.
Okay.
I don't like that word. It's like how some people don't like the word moist. You know? I don't like the word stakeholder. I forgot what we were talking
about. Very similar. You're talking about the fans. The fans, they showed their power, right? They showed their power in this situation with the Super League. And I think if you are Don Garber, you're taking a big, deep breath and you're saying, okay, we're good. We don't need to worry about competition for butts and seats from European teams, at least beyond the ICC. And that's a good thing for Major League Soccer in some ways. And in to your point, Sam, I think it's a bad thing in the case of accelerating growth of Major League Soccer feeling the pressure to basically to get better faster in order to continue its trajectory. They certainly don't feel that way or haven't indicated that they feel that way about their television numbers, right? They feel pretty confident that the TV numbers,
they say they do. They appreciate that
they're going up. And you talk to ownership groups, they feel like it's all positive trends and that the over-the-top stuff, and really honestly, it's clearly not impacting them enough to fundamentally alter the rules or to accelerate the rate of growth, right? Yeah, like it's they're not changing rules.
That's a bet that they've made. We'll see what happens, and maybe it'll pay off, right? Maybe there's enough players in the game now, and maybe somebody makes a play for the tonnage and the volume. But if you look at the numbers, they're not great. Like I looked them up today, and the two games that were on network television this weekend on ABC and Fox. Both drew less than 500,000 viewers on those networks. That's not good. You know, that's less, significantly less than what the college gymnastics championship drew this weekend on network television during the daytime. That's kind of the ballpark that MLS is playing in here. And those aren't great. Maybe they get a big TV deal anyway, right? Maybe it doesn't matter. But I don't think anyone is happy about that at the league. Like, they shouldn't be. And it's a shame, too, by the way, because this, like, we haven't even talked about the first week of games. They were good games, man. I thought the soccer was good. It was much better than I thought it was going to be, even accounting for some of the rust that we saw.
Yeah, it depends on what games you saw. I mean, like, my squad that I picked to finish second in the league, the Red Bulls, in no way attempt to play.
But oh my God, how have we made it this far into this show, by the way? My man, Chicharito.
Yeah, how did we make it this far?
We made it 45 minutes into the show.
We should wait till after the break to get into all this stuff, because we do have to acknowledge both the positives and negatives of our preseason prediction after 1 week. Our way too soon reactions to our preseason.
All right, well, let's do that, but let's close the loop on Super League stuff first. Okay, and let's talk a little bit about Liga MX and MLS, and let's dig more into that, because... You know, I was talking to people the other day, and I was like, well, what do you think this means? Because, like, this sort of, in my mind, it's just like, okay, it explodes everything. Let's reset, and let's evaluate the next steps. And I'm sure people at the league are thinking those same things, right? And what does this mean for League's Cup, right? Maybe this is a situation where League's Cup next year, instead of being 8-8, maybe it's 12-12. From MLS and Liga MX in terms of the number of teams in it. Maybe League's Cup is a thing that gets tacked on to the end of the season or the beginning of the season and is a separate month-long tournament with every team from both leagues involved, right? I don't know.
We saw that in the BCG study. That's what BCG recommended.
Was to do a
winter tournament, which, by the way, also makes sense in solving a big problem for Major League Soccer, which is that their offseason is way too long.
Yeah, and like it's not dissimilar really from what we saw in the CONCACAF Champions League last year, right? When they did it in Orlando at the end of the season or after the season because of COVID. So I don't know, like you would have to work through some logistics there. Both Liga MX and MLS have playoffs. So if you were to do it at the end of the season, you would have teams entering that tournament after like having a month plus off. The ones that didn't make the playoffs, so that would be interesting. You could do an Apertura Clausura thing. Right, where the first half is all domestic, and then the second half is mixed. It's an interleague. There are a million different things you can do, man. But like, it's interesting because I'm excited for those possibilities, and it's not the same feeling that I had about Super League. And I think a lot of American fans would maybe feel the same way. Some wouldn't. Some won't like this. I think Mexico, the response will be different because there is more history there, right? And they are more kind of steeped in their ways.
And they think that they would be slumming it. Let's be honest. Like, they're in that, in the minds of the many, many, many fans in Mexico, this league...
Shoot, man. Liga MX should not be... No one in MLS can beat Liga MX teams.
They shouldn't be playing. They shouldn't be playing down to MLS. It's more valuable to go play in Copa Libertadores and in South America, right? So it would be a real problem, I think, for Mexican fans.
Yeah. So there's that aspect to it, too. I don't know. It's all fascinating to me. And, like, we need to write a story and just buckle down and, like... figure out, okay, what could this look like? Or just like even fantasize about it. Just outline a dream scenario or how we would do it or whatever. But I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on what want it to be?
That's the most allocation disorder thing ever, is like fantasize about it. Like that is sadly the thing that like we would be like, let's dream up our MLS Liga MX.
What are you trying to say?
Competition.
What are you trying to say about
that
us?
We are huge nerds, and that's nothing new on this podcast. Everyone knows that already. It's okay.
I feel like this is one of the less nerdy things that we talk about on this show.
Yeah,
it's probably a lot less nerdy than MLS roster rules. That's for damn sure.
How dare you?
I won't take that back.
How dare you? There is nothing nerdy about discovery claims. Okay.
And with that, we'll go to a break. And we are back. Final segment of this week's show. Paul, week one of MLS is in the books. It feels like it was a million years ago. It was 4 or 5 days ago. But, you know, Super League happened between. But we should spend some time talking about week one, because I thought it was a pretty good week one. I enjoyed it. I watched a lot of the games. Some things stuck out to me. What stuck out to you?
A couple things. First of all, I think Austin plays good soccer. That doesn't surprise me. I think we talked about it in our preview show that Josh Wolf was, you know, went with a roster build that was similar to Nashville, but with a totally different idea of how to play soccer.
Yeah.
I was impressed by them in the loss to LAFC. I think that they're going to be pretty competitive if they play that level of soccer throughout the current year, the whole year. Of course, that comes down to depth and injuries and all those things that I talked about in the
figuring
show.
It out in the final third.
That stood out to me. Sam, I'm going to steal something that I think you're going to say. I think, you know, Miami showed more than I expected them to in the first week. I think that was a big, big thing that stood out from the first week. And the other thing was that, my squad, Red Bull, early on, they are going to just make games ugly as hell.
That was a rock fight.
Yeah, they're just going to run and run and run and run and run. There's not going to be a ton of beautiful soccer, at least early on. I think that will change over the course of the season as they get more of these reinforcements in, but not that much. Not that much. I don't think I think they'll be better when they're on the ball than they were in the first week of the season.
Sure.
But the style that they play is meant to disrupt, which is why I picked them to finish so high, because they're going to be really hard to play against.
They were really hard to play against Saturday against Kansas City. They had two mistakes. Kansas City punished both of them. And outside of that, SKC didn't really have any other looks. Like, that was pretty much
they're just going to be very difficult to play against. I'm not backing down from my prediction, except for the fact that I think it's going to take a while for them to be like a complete team, and that's probably going to hurt their chances to finish second. But I think they're going to be really tough to play against. There might also be tough to watch if you're like a viewer who likes to watch like possession soccer.
Man, I don't know when they play DC the first time, but I want to go see that match in person, because DC played even more like, we're not even going to care about having the ball even a little bit. We're just going to press super high and super hard and like see what happens. DC did even more of that than the Red Bulls did, and DC scored two awesome goals in their win against NYCFC. So that was interesting. That was one of the things that stood out to me this weekend was Hernan Losada and how hard those guys were working, how organized they looked. I was like, DC has a clear idea of what they want to do. It's not the prettiest, but they have a real shape. They're organized and it's working and they're fighting hard. So I thought that was good after a long year for United. And of course, my man, Chicha, scoring a couple of goals for the LA Galaxy in that 3-2 win against Miami, who did look good. Rodolfo Pizarro, he keeps playing like that. Best 11 He was really good in that game.
Yeah, he was really good.
Miami ran out of gas big time.
Sam, come on. I mean, Chicharito was great. Not just the way he played, but the post-game interview. Sam, did you cry when you watched this post-game interview?
I was imagining cosas chingonas, my friend. Chicharito was too. Chicharito almost cried in that interview. That was real, man. I liked it. I was like, also like, this is the longest answer I've ever heard in a post-game on-field interview.
I texted you that after I saw that interview that Chicharito.
Yeah,
because
you didn't see it live, did you? You turned off the TV or something?
I watched it on Twitter. Yeah, I turned off the TV as soon as the game ended, and when I saw it on Twitter, I texted you. I texted you the link, and I was like, "Yo, Chicharito's gonna win the Golden Boot."
Yeah.
I think you were still emotional at that time. It was like an hour after the game. You were still feeling it. You were vibing.
I was like, over. He's gonna get 18 plus, and everyone was like, ha, "You idiot." Well, let me tell you something, Paul. It's only one week in, but he's on pace for 68. Okay, he's on pace to clear 18 by 50.
This is an analytics podcast. You know what I'm saying? We just go by the numbers.
I'm not great at math, but I'm good enough to do it like that. So, yeah, I thought that was super encouraging. The Galaxy weren't very good in the first half of that game. They got outplayed big time. It looked a lot like 2020 Galaxy, where it was just like, okay, we're decent in the defensive and middle third on the ball. And then once we get to the final third, it's get it wide and cross it to Chicharito, who is by himself in the box. It's just like throw up a prayer. And it worked. It went predictably. It was poor. And then Greg Vanney shifted to a two-forward setup, brought on Ethan Zubac. He was able to kind of run the channels, serve more as a focal point. Victor Vasquez, you know, a little bit more defined in his role. And Chicharito was able to do his thing and sort of ghost around in the box and worry less about getting on the ball and worry more about getting on the ball in dangerous spots.
Hey, man, credit to Greg Vanney for the tactical change he made going to the 4-4-2. That's something I don't think we've seen with the Galaxy for a while. Kind of a good read on a game and a good read on a tactical change that opened things up.
Yeah, like 5 years, a while probably.
It's been a while.
So yeah, that was interesting to see. I was curious to see. Awesome win for Vancouver. Probably no one watched that game. It was the last one Sunday night. But similar vibe to what Kansas City and what DC did. You know, really organized, strong defensive shape. Stole one on a set piece and really limited chances for the Timbers. I thought it was curious that the CCL participants struggled hard. Makes sense in hindsight. Montreal waxed Toronto. I thought that was, I mean, it was kind of a cool story, but I'm not worried about any of those CCL teams considering they're on pretty short rest. A lot of them trotted out similar lineups to what they used midweek to all advance. Did you watch Columbus Philly?
I did.
What'd you think of that one?
Because
like I've had like a couple people I've spoken with been like, that was a really high level game, and I was like, man, that one was kind of a snooze. Like I didn't think it was great. I didn't think it was the cleanest. Like yes, it was two teams with clear ideas and clear systems, but like I thought they were both a little sloppy.
Yeah, I agree with you in that people definitely that we've talked to have said positive things about that game. It doesn't surprise me. Those teams had played a couple games in Champions League. They're going to be a little bit sharper than the rest of the teams.
I didn't think they were that sharp, though.
It didn't stand out. The game didn't stand out to me. In fact, I watched like I had the game on TV and I watched it in kind of like bits and pieces. Like I was like losing interest over the course of the game, to be honest.
Any other notes from the week? I have one more. Colorado Dallas for me.
Yeah,
that was a sneaky entertaining 0-0, at least in the first half. Dallas was playing a 3-4-2-1, which a few different teams did this week, which is not something we've seen a lot of in MLS before. And it didn't look good in the first half, like at all. I thought Hollingshead was a little bit lost on the right, and that was leaving a ton of room for Colorado to get into. They couldn't score, but it was a decent game, decent watch. I think both of those teams will be solid this year.
And I wouldn't hit the panic button if I'm Minnesota United fans. Like, they were... They were a good team in the first half. They struggled, obviously, badly in the second half, and I thought the score line was not indicative of the game. But, you know, and they still have reinforcements to add in Minnesota. I wouldn't hit the panic button if I was there. I also wouldn't hit the panic button if I was a Toronto fan. Certainly not. So,
NYCFC, I'm not hitting that panic button either, although a lot of fans are. I'm kind of on an island a little bit on that one, but that's okay. I'm comfortable. Island vibes, man. That's what I like.
Chicago Fire, they've got a lot to figure out, man. If
they
give up,
me about the Fire.
If they give up that many goals on set pieces, if they're that bad defensively on set pieces, again, they're not going to make the playoffs. It's that simple. They
tell
can't
me
defend
why,
set pieces.
Tell me why they're not going to be that bad again. They didn't change anything.
No, I mean, they actually have, I think, better fullbacks than the ones that they played the other night. Bornstein, I think Navarro was hurt. He came on late as a sub, as a winger, but I don't think he was able to play the full 90. They have another right back that they signed, who I think they should take a long look at, because I just don't think Sekulic is going to cut it. But to me, man, it's the set piece defending. That not only did they give up two goals on set pieces, one was a throw in, but they gave up
that
multiple,
defending was atrocious.
Multiple looks, multiple good looks at goal on corner kicks and direct kicks throughout the game. It needs to get fixed.
Did Pineda play?
Yeah.
Yeah, he played. Okay. Him and Kapilov started?
Calvo started the game. Did All Pineda right. play? It was Calvo and Kapilov to start the game.
So Pineda did not start?
Correct. He did not start.
Okay. That's what I meant. Come on, man. You knew what I meant. Why are you doing me like that, bro?
I didn't know what you meant. And in fact, I don't even know if he came on as a sub or not, but I believe it was Kapilov and Calvo at the start of the game. Clearly, I very closely watched this game.
We're ending this show with a bang. Actually, I will end this show with a fun note. Earlier this week, my mom sent me a text. It was a whole entry display at a grocery store of Dunkaroos.
Shout out to your mom for listening to the show.
Dunkaroos, they're back.